More than one-fifth of the foods we Americans now eat comes from Walmart. Which leads us to ask, how did one grocery store get to be so big so fast?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 782nd edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Luganville who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Rick O'Shea on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
Folks, you may find this hard to believe, but I live in a community that has no Walmart Supercenter. Oh, I can get to a Walmart by driving an hour or so, but I do not. I have, however, developed a long-distance fascination with how this store came to sell America more than one-fifth of its food, which is more than the combined sales of its three top competitors. Imagine that. Wow. Then a couple of weeks ago, I was introduced to a book by Tracy McMillan. Like, I don't know if you folks remember John Howard Griffin, but he was a journalist who painted himself black to write Black Like Me. Tracy is a journalist who dressed up as a Walmart grocery clerk to write The American Way of Eating. Tracy spying on America's Supercenter provides us with a perfect opportunity to ask, how did one grocery store get to be so big so darn fast? And who better to ask than Tracy herself? Tracy, welcome to the Food Chain Radio program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you aboard. You're on the East Coast, correct? New York City?
I am. I'm in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn. Good for you. The American Way of Eating. Why did you come to write The American Way of Eating and go underground, no less, to do it?
Right. Well, I really found that the further I moved along in my career, I'm actually trained as a welfare reporter. I really became
a welfare reporter?
Welfare and poverty. So for the first part of my career, I focused on sort of low-wage work and welfare issues. And the further I got along in my career, the more I really became fascinated with the way things really work at the bottom level of the economy for folks working there. And so food is a really interesting lens through which to tell that story. And I actually sort of bumped into it accidentally when I was covering a cooking class, which I thought would be just sort of this fluffy and easy story. It was a cooking class for high school students in public schools in New York. And all the students would say, well, we can't get this kind of food that we're being taught about in our neighborhoods. And so I undertook the first study of food access in New York City and sort of came up with a bunch of metrics and created a guide by zip code so that people could tell what was in their neighborhood and not. And that just seemed like a really rich way to talk about structure and opportunity in the U.S. and really get into what it's like, you know, for families who are doing the work to clean our houses and staff supermarkets and things like that.
So you started from looking at poverty, and you ended up in food. And you know, one of the most interesting statistics that popped out of your book was the fact that two-thirds of the young people between 18 and 24 could not cook a meal.
Right. So what was really interesting to me as someone, you know, who does a lot of policy and social science reporting is that there's very little social science about our cooking skills. So I believe that number came from, I think it was a Home Ec survey or something, but there's only a few studies that actually get at this of, you know, how much people know how to cook and what their skills are like. And one thing that sort of really crystallized things for me was thinking about the fact that, you know, when we moved into an economy where supporting a family required two incomes, and so women needed to move into the workforce, we didn't just take away, you know, families' abilities and time to cook for themselves, but also, you know, the time and ability to teach kids how to cook, because obviously when you're juggling a lot of different responsibilities and work and your kids and all of that, you know, cooking is enough work as it is. Teaching your kids how to do it sort of makes that a much more difficult prospect, and so I really feel like we're seeing the fallout of that as we move forward.
And it's really interesting how that one statistic kind of blends into what you learned about Walmart and about the food we Americans now eat. And so why Walmart? Why did you select Walmart? Why did you select to go underground? And why did you go to Detroit to do it?
Right. So I picked Walmart just because it's the largest grocer in the U.S. and the world. So if we're looking at how Americans eat, you kind of need to go to Walmart. They are the sort of biggest common denominator for everybody.
By far.
They're selling, I think it's about 23 or 24% of groceries in the U.S. Some folks have put it higher than that. And they sell, it depends on sort of which market they're in. So that, that 23-24% is a national average. If you're looking at sort of local retail markets, right, which is where everybody shops, here in Brooklyn, I am not pricing out my grapes against the cost of grapes in California, right? I'm sort of constrained by geography.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of geographic areas, Walmart actually represents more than 50% of the local grocery market. And so I was really interested in sort of getting into that. And so I went to Detroit because Detroit is known as being a food desert, and I thought that there would be no better place to really learn, sort of how grocery works than to actually go to a place where, it arguably was not working so well.
Mm-hmm. And when you say food desert, for people who have not heard the term, what exactly does that mean?
Right. So food desert is a term that's probably about a decade old now, and it refers to communities where there are insufficient grocery stores for the population there. So the industry standard, if a supermarket is looking at, where is it going to put in a new store, industry standard is to have about 3 square feet of retail space per person. And so there's roughly 13 or 14 million Americans right now who live in communities with less than that. And I think it's really important to remember that this is a very crude metric. We're sort of in the very early stages of talking about access to food as a public health concern.
Have they figured out a metric for liquor store square footage per person?
That possibly exists within the convenience store community, but I don't know what it is.
Okay, good. Well, Detroit, fascinating city, home, of course, of Henry Ford, who really brought industry to America in a wonderful sort of way, which is kind of how you end your book. But I wonder if you had that ending in mind when you first went to Detroit. Was that book?
No, I actually didn't really have any thought about industry and Henry Ford and all of that. I just, I'm actually from Michigan originally. I'm from outside of Flint. I'm from a sort of white working class background. And so my family still lives in that part of the state. And so I go back frequently.
Oh, okay.
I've done some reporting there.
Right.
And I really thought that it was interesting to sort of see Detroit as, this place that has, people talk about its abandonment, but really what they're talking about, right, is the depopulation of a large area. There's still a lot of people there. The last census still had about 750,000 people living there, so it's not empty. It's just that it's a large city with less population than it was.
How many Walmarts did you find in the city limits of Detroit?
Oh, there are no Walmarts in the city limits of Detroit. They're all confined to the suburbs, as are all the national grocers at this point.
Why are there no supermarkets in the city limits of Detroit?
Supermarkets decided that there wasn't money to be made in Detroit. That's changing. Whole Foods is actually going to be opening a store there next year, I believe. And Meijer, which is sort of a large regional grocer, is going to be opening a store that's been in process for a very long time. So we'll see how long that takes. And it's important to note that, when you say, if you say Detroit has no grocery stores, it's important to say that it's no national grocery stores, because there are about between 80 and 100 grocery stores, depending on sort of what you define as a grocery store within the city limits. It still has the average square footage per person about 1.5 square feet. And so, that's significantly less than the industry considers standard.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to take us back in time a little bit so we can kind of track the evolution of our grocers and how they started really as small local grocery stores, essentially selling local groceries, right?
Yeah. So I actually was really fascinated with, sort of how did supermarkets develop? Because the more I studied this, I sort of thought, food retailers and grocers are basically like, the plumbing and the sewer lines for food, right? Like we sort of build all this infrastructure for water.
I'm going to mention that to some of my grocer friends. I'm sure they'll enjoy that
one. I don't mean, in a bad way, right? Like sewers are necessary to run things.
Amen to that.
Structure for it. And so, you know, retailers for food have sort of filled in that service for us when it comes for meals. And so grocery stores actually started in New York City, or just outside of it, during the 1930s, so at the very beginning of the Depression, but also at the end of a huge expansion of industrial agriculture and food processing.
Okay, we're going to have to hold that. We're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, we're going to learn about the evolution of grocery stores and how it all started in New York City, of all places. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking with Tracy McMillan, who has a wonderful new book out called The American Way of Eating. Get this. Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. And we're going to talk about going undercover. We're going to talk about spying on Walmart and what we can learn by going undercover and working as grocery clerks at the nation's largest grocery chain, Walmart. Almost 25% of the food we eat now comes from this one store. Oh my goodness, how did it get so big so fast? We will be right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, we're back, and going way back to like the 1930s or so, before food came in packages, it came in bulk. And in grocery stores around the world, the grocer would be the person standing behind the counter, and when you went in for some flour, they'd dip a bucket into a big bucket of flour and measure you out some out, and if the grocer was fair, they wouldn't put their thumb on the scale. They would give you good weight. But then around 1930, things changed, and we're learning about that change. Today, we're talking with Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating. Tracy, King Cullen.
Yeah, so it's actually really fascinating. There was this A&P manager named Michael Cullen who got a bit obsessed, actually, with the idea of being able to sell food on an industrial economy of scale. And this was something that really wasn't possible before 1930. The teens and 20s were a time when agriculture and food processing both industrialized and became sort of more regimented. And so all of a sudden it was possible to package food in boxes and be able to sell it off parceled out in ways that it hadn't been before. And so Michael Cullen had this brainstorm that you could sort of, you know, pile it high and sell it cheap. And he really did that and blew all the other competition out of the water. It was very fascinating. If you look back at news accounts of the time, there were a lot of efforts by small grocers, particularly folks like, and when I say small grocers, I mean places that had a small physical footprint. So A&P, right, at the time was about 600 square feet for a typical store. And A&P and sort of the other sort of
That would make it kind of like a 7-Eleven or something like that.
Right, really quite small. And they actually organized politically and tried to get legislation passed to block sort of selling in the method that Michael Cullen was doing. But his model just really took off like wildfire, particularly because, you know, it was the early 30s, so we're in the middle of a depression. Saving money was really important for folks. And so you sort of see this infrastructure just take off because all of a sudden, instead of having, you know, lots of stores go to wholesale markets and go to butchers and things, and people going to butchers separately and things like that, you start to see these supply chains begin to consolidate. And that's something, you know, that sort of evolved slowly and then really took off in the 50s with suburbanization, which was the next big push for supermarkets.
Right. And, you know, with respect to that kind of supermarket, the King Cullen model that it developed, it was really the packaging of food that made all of this possible, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is something, you know, I had never really thought of before, but The idea of packaging food in preset amounts, preserving it for shelf life and making it something that could sit on the shelf for a long time without going bad, these were huge advances in terms of being able to change the way retail happened.
You made an interesting comment with respect to the benefit to a consumer. You know, were a consumer to go into the old style store and request of the grocer some flour, but you were kind of dependent upon what the grocer, you know, was going to give you. But with this new model of packaged goods, you make the selection. You're in charge.
Yeah, there's actually been some very interesting scholarly work done by sort of feminist home economists pointing out that, you know, for women who were doing that kind of shopping, it meant that, you know, the local grocer knew everything that you ate in your house. They could sell things to you. So, you know, A&P had a lot of house brands, so they would try and push, you know, their own products. And they're the gatekeeper for most of the products that you're going to get. So you, you know, say, oh, I want a tin of this. I want a few pounds of flour and all of that. And you had to sort of negotiate and navigate that with this one shopkeeper. And that's something that, to me, you know, as someone who grew up reading Little House on the Prairie, sounds, you know, sort of very nostalgic and cute and small towny, but, you know, within this context of having somebody else sort of pushing different decisions on me and talking about me, you know, and there's also for families of color, it became difficult, right? Because if people were racist, right, you would have to deal with that in a shop, whereas if you just go in and pick something off the shelf, you know, you can just sort of get in and out and mm-hmm. be done with it.
And the irony, of course, is that the grocers know more about us today than they probably ever did, even when they sold them direct to us. It's pretty strange that how that worked out.
Yeah, particularly with all those loyalty cards.
And let's talk about the supermarkets, how they evolved really as distribution systems. It wasn't just the storefront, but the whole back end, like you said, the plumbing, that was really became interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, if you look at the way the supermarket industry works now, the big retailers, so, you know, Walmart or Meijer or Super Value, all those places, they're not even really competing on price at the store level for consumers. Where they're really competing is in their distribution networks, because you can basically increase your profit margin not by drawing in more customers, but by changing how much you're paying sort of before you get to the store floor. And so it's, at this point, all of that infrastructure is really how supermarkets are able to save consumers money, right? They bring all of that functioning in-house. So now Walmart basically controls everything between the farm gate and the store floor, pretty much.
Well,
once they brought all in-house.
And through the prescription buying practices, they really control even beyond the farm gate to the farmer sitting at the kitchen table wondering whether to plant this crop or not. Because they really do control the price of almost everything now, right?
It's true, and I'm not trained in economics, but I got a good education in working on the American way of eating and something called a monopsony. And so most Americans are familiar with Monopoly, right, because we all play the board game. But monopsony is a condition where a retailer is so powerful it can dictate to the suppliers what price it will pay, and that's a position that Walmart finds itself in, you know. Because when we learn sort of basic capitalist economics in grade school, you know, it's like I am someone who has a product and I'm going to sell it to multiple buyers, and whoever will give me the best price, you know, is who I will sell it to. And as a producer, you have some control, in part because you can go to different buyers. But at this point, Walmart controls such a large share of the market, it's in a position to be able to dictate what price it will pay to the suppliers, as well as, you know, what price it will charge consumers.
And thus, it is in control of the entire distribution network from planting seeds all the way to the consumer. And that it controls almost one-fourth of the nation's food. That's a significant amount of power. Let's talk about supermarket foods and the kinds of foods we get at the supermarket. You made an interesting comment about being kind of raised on Hamburger Helper. Along the way, I've never had Hamburger Helper, but I think I remember the jingle, Hamburger Helper makes a great meal, or something like that. But what exactly is, and it kind of epitomizes supermarket, the packaged foods that you talk about in supermarkets, right?
Yeah, I mean, I should point out, you know, I have a real fondness for Hamburger Helper and foods like that. My main quibble with it would be pretty much like the sodium content and the health content. And something that I thought was really fascinating.
Well, first of all, what is it? I haven't had any, so I don't know. But
right. I mean, so Hamburger Helper, right, is usually some noodles, a flavoring packet, and then you still have to buy, like, oiled beef, and usually there's, like, some milk involved.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, it'll just make...
So you kind of cook it all up, throw it in a big pot, and there you are.
Yeah, you brown the beef, you add in the flavoring packet, some milk, and the noodles, and you let it cook up.
Okay.
And it's actually something that I as sort of a little exercise, I said, oh, well, let's see if I can make something similar from scratch and how long it takes and what the cost is. And I was like, you know, it'll probably take longer to do it from scratch, but it'll probably, and it'll probably be cheaper if I use Hamburger Helper, but like, let me just see. And I was shocked because it was maybe like a quarter of the price to make it from scratch as it was to use Hamburger Helper, and it only took 1 minute more.
So that is an interesting observation. What led you to do that? Just out of curiosity?
Just curiosity, because I said, well, you know, I'm thinking that it's easier and cheaper for me to use the box. Like, is it really?
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of did this little experiment. I said, gosh, it's not actually that much more. It's like one extra minute. And then I have control over the quality of the ingredients.
Well, that really kind of points out the secret to the food processing industry. You know, you take a penny's worth of corn and turning it into a dollar's worth of corn flakes.
Right.
And that's where the money is.
Yeah, I mean, and in terms of making things convenient and easy for folks, and this is one thing, you know, I don't begrudge working parents any interest.
But it only costs you an extra minute.
Right, that's the thing, is I think that particularly because folks don't necessarily feel like they know how to cook very well, it makes it really difficult for folks to feel like it's convenient to do that. And actually, I think a lot of what something like Hamburger Helper does is it just takes out the decision-making, right?
We're going to have to hold on to that. When we come back, I'd like to ask Tracy McMillan about the fresh foods in the giant supermarkets. How convenient are they? We will be right back after this important message. Do stay tuned to the Food Chain. One store, Walmart, sells us about one-fourth of the food we eat. Oh my goodness, how did one store get to be so big so quick? Well, one person who might know, Tracy McMillan, who went undercover, dressed up as a grocery clerk, and went to work at Walmart. So we're going to learn what she learned when she was spying on America's Supercenter. Tracy, goodness sakes, this Walmart store, it hasn't been in business all that long. And yet today it sells us all, like you say, 23-24% of our food. How did you go about getting a job at Walmart in the first place anyway, in Detroit no less?
Right. Well, it's actually not really difficult. I mean, it's difficult because of the economy, so it did take me about 3 weeks to get in into an actual position. But, you know, I'm from Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
I am just, you know, if I wear a sort of normal-looking outfit that is not sort of New York stylish, I blend in pretty easily. In Michigan, there's lots of broke white people there. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I just applied places, and, you know, and I used an authentic resume. I left out the part where
I'm
a journalist.
You left out the part where I'm spying on you, right?
Right. I didn't say, by the way, I'm hoping to write about this. I mean, pretty interestingly, during the period when I was working at Walmart, the New York Times had a reporter go and spend a day working at Walmart with the permission of the company. And so she was accompanied the entire time by assistant managers. She was given her shirt and khakis, which were things that, as you know, someone who was hired off the street, I had to actually purchase, which when you're making $8 an hour is kind of a big deal.
Right.
And so she had a very different experience than I did going to work there. So, you know, it's not that difficult to go in and sort of say, you know, look, my family's here. My grandma's having a hard time, which was true at the time. And, you know, I'm trying to help out, and I need to earn some money, but I don't have time to look for, like, a demanding job. I need something that can be flexible.
Mm-hmm.
With my schedule, and, you know, that worked within that environment.
Well, let's take an eagle's eye look at Walmart before we go inside the doors with you. Here's a chain of stores that really discovered quite a formula. What is it? Save money, live better.
Right.
But it was not in the inner city that they made this discovery. Where was it exactly?
was in the rural South. And so interestingly, SNAP, you know, I went through a couple of the orientations, so you learn a lot about the company's history and how it sees itself. And Sam Walton's argument when he started opening up Walmart discount stores, right, where they were selling mostly, you know, home goods and sporting goods and things like that, was that, you know, these were markets where people wanted those products if they could get to them easily and could afford them. And to me, it was interesting because that really mirrors a lot of the discussion you see around supermarkets in the inner city now. Because prior to Sam Walton making that argument and going into those stores, department stores said, well, those communities don't want our products. Those aren't our markets. You know, we sell to affluent suburban people or affluent urban people, but we don't sell to the rural people because they don't want our things. And it's a very similar discussion to what you sometimes hear people make about
the food deserts
in the inner city.
Yeah, about the food deserts, yeah, filling in. So, but he did it, and he did it in the rural areas of America. And how did he do it? What was the secret to his stores? Are you there? I think we lost her, maybe, huh? Goodness. Well, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson here. Somehow we've lost our connection with Tracy McMillan, but we're doing our best to pick her up again. Don't know if I press the wrong buttons. I have a tendency to do that. So we're talking about food in America. We're talking about America's largest grocer, Walmart. And we're looking at picking up some intelligence from Tracy McMillan, who went underground and worked in the Walmarts as a grocery clerk. And we're taking kind of an eagle's eye look now and seeing where this Walmart came from the Deep South, and how it developed in such a huge way to take over, gosh, almost 25% of the food we eat here in the United States. Simply an amazing amount of food. It's almost impossible to imagine how one store could develop the capability to supply us with all that food. Incredible. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. We've learned some really interesting facts, of course, talking about the inner cities of the country and how they've become essentially food deserts. You look at a place like Detroit, no supermarkets there. Why? Because people who own the supermarkets are essentially afraid to sell there. And I think we have Tracy back. Are you there, Tracy?
Yeah. Hi. Sorry about that. I don't know what happened.
Well, sometimes these bugs creep into these new technologies, you know. And that's one of the things I was going to ask you about. When so much of America's food is concentrated in the hands of so few people, what happens when a bug gets in the system like it just did with our radio here?
Right. So we haven't seen what happens, but I'm not super optimistic about that, right? You know, if something suddenly happened to Walmart's, I don't know, their satellite system, you know, they have a very advanced infrastructure for tracking their inventory.
Right, right.
Or if, you know, suddenly they went bankrupt because there was something wrong with their accounting, you know, that would mean all of a sudden a quarter of our groceries weren't moving around. And interestingly, because Walmart had pioneered this sort of just-in-time delivery service where, you know, they have such a tight handle on their inventory that they have very little extra stuff on site. You know, you used to have grocery stores would have these big warehouse rooms in the back that would have, you know, a few weeks of supplies. Now at Walmart, it's just a few days' worth.
A few minutes' worth of supplies. Yeah, I just wonder about that because a couple of years ago here in the in our market, there was a labor dispute from the telecommunications industry, and somebody crawled down a manhole with a chainsaw and cut his way through a fiber optic cable, and everything shut down. You could not buy a gallon of gasoline. You could not buy anything at the store. You could not make a phone call. You could not. You could walk across the street, but that would be about all. You could, you know, everything was completely shut down. So when I see something like Walmart, I just kind of scratch my head. They've done this incredible job of fine-tuning their distribution system so that they control everything from essentially from seed to table and everything in between. And yet it's boy, kind of scary, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, I really ran into a lot of, I just started thinking a lot about, you know, when we talk about companies being too big to fail, You know, it's terrible when it's a bank or an automobile company that's employing a lot of people, but I feel like those are things you can replace. Ultimately, it doesn't immediately ruin people's ability to survive, but when you talk about building a food system that is too big to fail and yet is so vulnerable because it's so concentrated, for me, that makes me a bit uncomfortable. I don't really like the idea that, a few fiber optic cables go down, you get a corrupt person in charge of something at Walmart, any of that happens and you lose a food supply. That to me is not a good idea.
Yeah, so it's just a parenthetical brought about by the fact that we just lost our communication link here, and then all of a sudden you don't have a radio show. So gosh, what would happen if somebody pulled the plug on Walmart's satellite? Just a thought. When we come back, I'd like to ask you about going undercover and why you targeted the grocery aisles of Walmart and what you discovered when you were there. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson on the line today with Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields, and the Dinner Table. Boy, that's about 40 hours of conversation there, Tracy. Right back.
Great shot, Bob. I think you're on.
I just followed your lead.
Hey, by the way, did you break ground on your new building?
No way. I'm holding off until I see what the future holds.
So you're seeing a fortune teller?
Know what I mean. Things look a little uncertain.
The only thing certain in business is if you're not growing, you're losing. And we just opened our fifth facility last week. If you're following my lead, you'll call General Steel. Their pre-engineered steel buildings could save you as much as half the cost compared to conventional buildings. And they're up in nearly half the time, and back with a 50-year structural warranty.
Yeah, but steel buildings...
Hey, you've seen my building. Does it look like steel?
No, it looks great.
Ask about rebates that could save you up to $20,000. Look, you can stop paying rent and own a building that suits your business better, and probably saves you money by operating more efficiently. In times like these, don't stop spending, just spend wisely.
Call 800-965-1290. 800-965-1290, 800-965-1290.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box. A heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to knoxgardenbox.com. That's K-N-O-X, gardenbox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a bear sighting.
Location?
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Well, folks, Tracy McMillan went undercover to work at Walmart in the grocery section specifically. And we ask her, what did you hope to find by working undercover at Walmart that you could not find by working above ground, as did the reporter from the New York Times do, Tracy?
Right. Well, I just really wanted to get as close to a realistic experience as a worker in that part of the food system as I could. And I didn't think, given that, press people tend to treat reporters very differently than managers treat sort of frontline workers.
That's the understatement of the year, right?
What I was doing, I didn't think I would sort of get a very good idea of what was happening. You know, for instance, when I was working on the night shift for a while, actually, outside of Kalamazoo, Michigan at Walmart, this was over the holiday season, I was scheduled to work about 42 hours one week. And so the day before the end of the pay period, my manager came up to me and said, oh, you know, look, you're going to hit overtime if you work your shift tomorrow. So just don't come in at all. So because even though they had scheduled me for 42 hours, and even though it only would have been 2 hours of overtime, she took away a day of my work for me. And that's something that's absolutely legal. It's within Walmart's right to tell me not to come in for that day. But that's, you know, something that really changed how I was able to support myself and how I was able to eat, because, you know, the idea with the book wasn't just that I would go and discover, you know, sort of mysterious secrets. And certainly because I was in each job for only 2 months, you know, I'm not going to find a whole lot. But I really wanted to be able to also have an experience of what is it like to try and eat well and support myself and feed myself when I'm working in these kinds of jobs, not just making those wages, but when my life has the same shape and feel that folks have when they're working in those jobs.
Well, you know, you talk a little bit about how Henry Ford revolutionized industry by hiring people and paying them enough to buy his cars. Now, is Walmart hiring people? Do they pay them enough to buy their food?
Typically, not really, right? So when I was working at Walmart, I was making, I worked at two Walmart stores. I made $8.10 at one of them, and I made $8.50 an hour at the other one. And, you know, that's not really enough to support a family. As a single person, I was scraping by, but I was in a very precarious financial position. You know, to be fair, right, Walmart is, I would argue, is most likely the largest acceptor of food stamps in the country, right? So they sort of get out of the Henry Ford bargain in a way because we have a food stamp program. So, you know, their workers can buy a lot of food at Walmart with the subsidies from the government, which, you know, I certainly think that people that are making $8 an hour need more money to buy food. But it's something where, you know, it sort of lets the employer off the hook about having to pay a reasonable wage to its workers.
That's a good question. You brought up a lot of things about the government food programs, which, you know, I guess Walmart sells a lot of food through those programs. And recently we've seen the government go to great lengths to expand the distribution of its food stamps and various food programs, even to the extent of creating Spanish language soap operas, you know, to increase the distribution of those food stamps. To what extent would you guess Walmart's food business would be in food stamps? What percentage? How's that for a question?
Right, and since I'm a reporter, I'm like, well, I don't have numbers in front of me, but I can tell you that I know that Walmart's market is typically lower-income families. Mm-hmm. So I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but I know when I was looking through some of their annual reports, you know, they definitely, you know, their shoppers skew towards the lower part of the income spectrum. And so I would guess that they do a pretty good business in food stamps.
I guess you would have to be a clerk or on the cash register to be able to have a sense of what those numbers would be. You know, you would be able to just thumbnail it or wet finger in the wind kind of rating system as to what extent Walmart's customers are food stamps there. What did you find when you worked in the grocery aisles of Walmart?
Well, you know, in the grocery aisles, it's all processed food. Grocery and produce are really separate. In the produce aisles, I certainly found no evidence whatsoever of the sort of corporate efficiency that we hear about. I worked under a 20-year-old kid who really had no idea how to take care of produce. And this, was for me, was really disheartening because the Walmart was one of two grocery stores in the town that I was in. So it was half the town's fresh food supply was basically entrusted to a 20-year-old who hadn't been trained properly. And so there was a day where I threw out 200 pounds of asparagus that had been rotting in the cooler for about a month.
You know, that was one of the questions. Your comments about Randy kind of floored me. Here's a 20-year-old kid who's got control of half the community's produce. Tell us about Randy.
Well, Randy was just just, you know, a 20-year-old kid. He worked at a fast food place doing delivery for them as well. So he was juggling two jobs. He had a background in electronics at Walmart. He had recently been promoted into management in the produce section. And so far as I could tell, he had no real training in how to organize or man a food section or how to make sure things were fresh. And some of that's got to be youth, I would think. You know, I don't know that I would have done a great job managing a food section at 20 years old. But I was really, really floored when I started to think of it in terms of this is our food supply. Like, this is the stuff that actually rots and it matters if it's taken care of or not. And it's being treated as if it's just sneakers. And, you know, I actually developed a real appreciation for how difficult it is to manage a produce section. You know, you have hundreds of items that are all dying at different rates, essentially, and you're trying to preserve them.
That's right.
Degree of freshness for
everything you have on display is busy dying.
Right. And I also, because I felt that the produce we were selling in that department was not very good quality, and I had other workers come up to me and say, you know, look, I bought peppers yesterday and I took them home and they were all full of mold on the inside. You know, so it wasn't just, you know, me being snooty.
It was that way. Quick break. We're going to go to the phones. I've got a whole bunch of people want to talk to you. I've been stealing all of your time myself. I'm so greedy. Right back. Well, so much to talk about, so many to talk about, people to talk about it with, but so little time to talk about it in. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating, Undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, and Farm Fields in the Dinner Table. What fun. I'm jealous. It sounds like my kind of job, especially the dinner table part. I love the dinner table. So I'm going to take some calls really quickly here. We're going to start off with Millie. There we go. Millie, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry. I could not remove my remote without disconnecting.
Oh, that's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to concentrate quickly on your earlier descriptions of how it was. I grew up when I was a very young child. We bought a new home in the Sunset area of San Francisco by the Pacific. And my mother didn't drive, neither did most of the housewives on my street. And the stores, as my childhood memory tells me, they were rather pathetic. But what we had were the wagons that came by every weekday. There was a wagon for bread. There was a wagon for fish. Then there were the daily vegetable wagons that had everything. And these vegetables came from the huge open-air produce section down by the ferry building. And all San Francisco did have farms in the outskirts of the huge San Francisco county. And so everything that anyone would need came to the door, including the Iceman.
I kind of like that idea. That would be that would be like the farmer's market coming to you.
Mobile market.
It was all high quality stuff. As my mother was brought up in a farm in southern Monterey County, so she knew good stuff when she saw it, and it was quality stuff, and that remained all through the 30s in my childhood memory. And I don't recall when they disappeared,
Millie, that's a great question, and thank you for bringing that up. And that'll take us back to Tracy. Tracy, can we get good stuff from Walmart? I mean, here's a company that brings stuff from thousands of miles away, and are we getting good stuff there?
Right. I mean, it really depends a lot, I think, on how dedicated the local produce manager is and how much they're really paying attention to the work that they're doing. You're never going to get farm fresh stuff, or very, very rarely will that happen. You can still get reasonable quality if everybody along the supply chain is really focused on doing their job and really making sure that people are getting good fresh quality. The one really interesting thing about Walmart's dominance in the marketplace is that because it's brought all of that distribution stuff in-house, it's really led to the decimation of the sort of wholesale produce markets and terminal markets
right.
around the country.
Nobody's bringing wagons around the neighborhood anymore with Walmart.
Right.
Wendy, really quickly, hurry.
Oh, I just wanted to say that, yeah, those managers, those people, they really need to personally care about because they don't get much training. And that consumers all over the place are losing because they are expecting a quality, knowledgeable person when they go into a store and talk to somebody.
And they get a 20-year-old who has not the slightest idea, probably never grew a vegetable. Tracy McMillan, author of The American Way of Eating, undercover at Walmart, Applebee's, Farm Fields. And gosh, you know, we could have talked for days, kiddo. Thank you so much for joining me on the Food Chain today. And thank you all for tuning in out there. Sorry we didn't get to all you folks on the phone. But we will be back next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain. And please remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.